Linda, this tape is New York City, August 17, 1966, the New York Shakespeare Festival. I had an interview this morning with Andrew Mihok, M-I-H-O-K, who is the production coordinator for the Shakespeare Festival's plays this season. In the first place, the Shakespeare plays are designed to play continuously and against a background of semi-permanent scenery that provides a unit stage. This allows the play to play with a minimum technical staff, using only the production coordinator, the stage manager for the production, and the assistant stage manager, plus the lighting people, and the sound people. Now, this idea of playing continuously and with nothing to change on stage except props means a great deal of speed in the production, as well as reduced staff in presenting the play. Several items of interest came up, the first being that this is the first theater I have seen using the new neck microphones that are radio transmitters. Several points came to light. Andy indicated that in the first place only a specific number of channels and a very restrictive number, a maximum possibly of 12, are available for channels or frequencies are available for this type of work, meaning that the plays have to be limited to exchanging 8 or 12 microphones between the various characters who must speak, and in scenes that require additional speaking parts, it's necessary for the play to be mic'd with additional microphones spread around what we'd call the footlight area, or at specific locations where they're hidden on stage. The mic'ing is generally effective, although the mics do allow a certain amount of background noise off the set to be picked up. The mics are all used in an on position and taped that way, placed around the neck of the person with the wire extending up over the shoulders, around the neck and around the waist to give a vertical loop and a horizontal loop to the antenna for pickup. The receivers for these units are housed below the stage, a very short distance for the radio waves to travel, and essentially, although they had to vary the frequency slightly to eliminate some of the city radio waves from use, mostly the proximity of the mic to the receiver causes the mic to blot out any peripheral sound that might be picked up. The microphones did not show any particular fading as people turned from the left to the right. They were all hidden in the clothes of the actors, and in some occasion they had even cut holes in some of the costumes to allow the neck of the mic to slip out. One problem that does occur is the fact that actors with heavy resonant voices and with a microphone too close to their chest tend to pick up hollow sounds, so they've had to make some provision to separate the mic slightly from the chest. These mics are battery powered, and the batteries have to be changed every 4 performances at a cost of about $2 a battery. This particular company is using 8 of the microphones plus 7 microphones placed in the footlight area for general pickup. The general pickup does unfortunately pick up some foot sounds, and it does show fading as the characters turn and move between the mic'd areas. Only slightly, but enough of an extent to be noticeable. The amphitheater with 2,400 seats has a good rake, a little greater than 20 degrees at the back. It's divided into 2 sections with a long aisle that goes from left to right, and then the vertical aisles, and there are 6 of them, divide the auditorium still further for easy access. The lighting is from booths in the back, as well as sound control, and the stage manager operates the production and gives all cues for all effects from that area. There are monitors placed backstage and in the dressing room so that the actors may hear the action as it progresses, and no actors are called for cues. All actors must make their entrances on their own responsibility. The properties use something a little different from what I have seen anywhere else, where permanent prop cabinets are sometimes placed in close proximity to the stage left and right. And here, the property cabinets are on rollers with doors and drawers that can open up in a large counter space on top, and each actor may pick up his props on the left-hand or the right-hand side of the stage, as the case may be, and return them to the proper place when he is through with them. At the end of the show, these props can be protected from the weather by being put in the racks. The cabinets are shut up. They're rather long, but they can then be rolled to shelter underneath the stage area. The shop space for props and for minor scenery and scenic repairs is located directly under the stage, which has a wooden top. Unfortunately, this wooden top is trapped, and occasionally braces or units must be put in, and it has developed a number of holes which cause leaks and water drainage into the basement work area, which is unfortunate. Oh, here's a paragraph that you probably ought to type, Linda, and then insert above the one I just gave you. This has to do with the mics, indicating that the responsibility for keeping the microphones off when they are off stage is the responsibility of the sound man. A regular plot is made of the use of the microphones, of who has it and who gives it to which actor in which scene, so that the sound man, as well as the performers, always know who is carrying each mic number, and therefore he can control the pots, knowing in advance who will be using which mic and which scene, and having a plot at his elbow for easy reference. Now we can drop down past the other paragraph. Maybe when you type this out, you can tape them up. The stage is covered with rubber matting, and unfortunately this has some holes poked in it. The rubber matting, though, is a good footing, not slippery, and it drains when the stage is in good shape. It drains fairly readily after a rain. The stage itself is a thrust stage, and the seats are placed in Greek styles in a semicircular manner around the thrust stage. The particular stage that they're using for productions at this moment has a slight tilt, or a platform with a tilt on it, which tends to help the visibility from all sections of the auditorium. Since the productions here do not charge admission, the problems of rainouts are not quite so severe or exacting as at some of the other theaters. However, the policy here is similar to those in other theaters, in that the actors will play as long as the audience is seated there. If it does rain, the play will be held up for a short period to determine whether the rain is only a sporadic downpour and it may clear. If the rain does not clear within about 15 minutes, the performance is canceled. There are no provisions as such for drying the costumes, so that considerable care must be taken that the costumes do not become rain-soaked. The system used is to hang the costumes, and there is space to hang them, but there is no forced drying unless the costumes would actually be shipped out to a commercial establishment for drying. These people work on a special contract with Actors Equity and essentially have 4 weeks rehearsal to mount the productions. The general system, of course, is to mount a unit set with only some pieces changing from plate to plate, and to set the lights for each play individually. This means a considerable lighting control, and in this case some 40 lights are mounted on metal rigs or towers to the left and right of the stage area. Lights are mounted within the wings, the temporary wings put up for the production to give side lighting. And lights are mounted on a bridge above the lighting control area at the rear of the theater. About 40 lights are so mounted to give direct overhead light at a good 45-degree angle coming from over the heads of the audience. The lighting equipment for this production is rented at a very low rate from one of the commercial lighting companies, who essentially make part of the rental cost their donation to the Shakespeare Festival here in New York. The lighting control runs toward 200,000 watts by silicon rectifier dimmer. Andy tells me that they've not had much trouble from the Klegel SCR dimmers, but that some of the other dimmers have given them trouble from time to time, particularly with blowing fuses for unexplained reasons. The lighting system is two-wire. A third ground wire is not considered necessary, and at no time have they had any severe trouble. Although Andy did tell me that he had noted while working on the outdoor productions at the Antioch Area Shakespeare Festival that occasionally it got wet enough to soak the asbestos wire leads to the various spotlights, causing electrical leakage and low-flow shortage that would sometimes make a whole metal tower live, even though it was grounded and wouldn't necessarily hurt anybody. It was a little uncomfortable to work with. This problem has not occurred here at the Shakespeare Festival, and with the exception of rainouts when they started this season and the rainout that occurred about halfway through the show last night, they've not been plagued by rain this summer. In the operation of the play, it is possible for the stage manager, the lighting director, and the sound director, or at least the people performing those duties during a production, see the production from the front, from the booth in the back of the house, and are able to control any emergency or any change in timing at all times. As I indicated earlier, Andy said that the stage manager actually controls the timing of the production to the point in two of the productions this year where he actually gives an entrance cue for an actor. In general, however, he is busy controlling the technical cues for lights and sound. In terms of construction of the amphitheater, I did notice an item in the dressing room that I think needs to be noted while we were touring the theater, and that is that the dressing rooms are built with overhead cabinets for each actor, much like kitchen cabinets where he can store things on the shelves. Also, each makeup space is fitted with a drawer. Very handy for the actor to keep his makeup or to keep anything in, and certainly in recommending the type of arrangement for various productions, I think we ought to include this drawer for the actors at every makeup position. I did feel that the hanging space for costumes was somewhat restricted in that they could have used more space in the actual dressing rooms. Dressing rooms are divided into cubicles rather than the makeup being placed all around the walls of a big room. This has semi-dividers which allow more actors to be accommodated, but there is a feeling of very tight, cramped space. The productions utilize different directors, but the staff is essentially the same for each of the productions during the season. It is possible that an assistant stage manager on one show might do props or something on one of the others. There is an attempt, as each show is being rehearsed, to have a special prop person have charge of that show in terms of a person who can work with the rehearsals during the daytime and then not have to be with the show during that night. This is also true of attempting to have one of the lighting crew who pays more attention to one show than perhaps he does to the others, so that someone is at hand to furnish a communication to each department. And also, the technical staff tries to keep during the rehearsal period and after at least one person on the prop staff available to run errands and make minor purchases wherever necessary for the rehearsal or for the production. Linda, this information came from an interview with the production coordinator of the festival. Now, on a separate paper, I would like to put down some notes about the arrangement of the amphitheater and the production that I saw. The production is played in an amphitheater which is built up from the ground. The rake on the seats, which are essentially wooden platformed stadium seats in a semicircular Greek fashion, is very good, allowing all members of the audience to adequately see the thrust stage where the action takes place. No side stages are used in this 2,400 seat amphitheater, and it is perhaps more Greek in style than Shakespearean. Pipe rigs allow steps and platforms to the left and right upstage so that action may be on various levels. Steps from the apron to the ground at the front row of seats allow the action to tumble down almost to the audience when necessary. It also gives a tie-in between the audience and the stage area so that you feel very close to the action. The stage itself has a basement and is trapped, and of course, as we indicated earlier, the basement area is used for a shop for prop building and minor repairs, and also for storage of props and certain other items for the play that's in production. The theater from the outside appears circular in shape, except for the stage area, which is open to the lake in the back, and only baffles and bits of scenery and wings tend to cut that off from the audience. The wings are painted black so as to absorb the light and to keep the focus on the stage area where the attention should be. The dressing room area is to the side in a separate building, and also an office for the production staff is in this building. During the production, the doors toward the stage are kept open so as to prevent anyone from wandering in and wandering through the dressing rooms, although there are side doors that can open into areas to each side of the stage. The production of Richard III was effective with the microphones. The acting individually is generally very good. I felt perhaps that the, although this borrows some from the original Shakespeare stage floor plan, that the general visual effectiveness of the productions in Ashland, Oregon was maybe a bit more colorful, a bit more generally rewarding in establishing the environment than was the scenery and essentially modern interpretation of the environment as expressed here in New York. The directing in Ashland also seemed to stem from a more common tradition of that particular theater, and one feels that the direction here is an independent thing without perhaps quite as complete a philosophy of handling Shakespeare as occurred at Ashland. A true comparison, perhaps, is not really wise, since they are different theaters, but the comparison, having seen both theaters recently, the comparison is there. The production of Richard III was fast-paced, played with a great deal of energy, and reaffirms one's idea that Shakespeare plays awfully well on the indeterminate outdoor stages in almost any type of environment. Script-wise, he wrote for a panoramic expression of his views, although he managed to keep his focus on the key leaders involved in the situation. It is doubtful that the theater could be much larger and still offer an effective production, at least in my mind. 2,400 seats, even at this steep rake and close proximity to the stage in the semicircular pattern, seemed to be a little much. Having sat down front for these performances and not having viewed them from the back, I may tonight want to amend that comment after I've seen it again. Most of the color in the production comes from the light striking the costumes. The costumes are very colorful, and some elements of the pageantry are used, although kept somewhat at a minimum. They are still used to expand some of the larger scenes. There are no group scenes as such to any real extent. A selection of people who are symbolic of groups, or who set the flavor or atmosphere of groups of what has been or what have been handled, keeping the level of the acting company down toward 25 to 30 people in most cases. It is also apparent that the cast has given great care to the thought of which props to use, and in handling the props within the scenes, in bringing the properties onto the scenes, and striking them when the scene is over, as the next scene is beginning to appear. This is all done by the cast, and the handling of the properties gives some feel of authenticity. I might also say that the handling of the costumes is done with confidence and a feeling that the people involved fit into these clothes. These are details, but very important to rounding out a production. To me, the use of the lighting equipment would indicate, although the lighting was adequate with sufficient backlighting, a feeling of mood following the creation of illumination and focus. My feeling was that the lighting could have been better affected by a choice of slightly larger instruments. It appeared to me that two instruments were being used, or sometimes three, in place of one, perhaps a quartz iodine of higher efficiency. Would have eliminated the use of so many circuits. The illumination was sufficient, but not great, and at no time was the lighting ever brilliant. The play does not lend itself, with the exception of a few moments, to brilliant lighting. The direction, I felt, was thoroughly interesting, with the exception of two or three moments where a symbolistic motion or a designed motion was so obvious that it destroyed the illusion of reality. The handling of the battle scenes, which are difficult in a Shakespeare play in any case, with the stage being divided up with one camp on one side and one on the other at brief moments, was not as efficient as I would have wished. Perhaps the battle was prolonged slightly. Perhaps also the director did not realize the ludicrous effect of having one group stalk on the stage and the other group stalk off, and could have used perhaps fewer people even to symbolize the battle than he did, except perhaps for the climactic moment. One very effective bit in the battle at the end was at Richard's death, when he is finally struck the blow which begins to lead to his death, as this battle scene is designed. The sounds of the battle, the fast pace of the battle, stop and freeze. The church music used at his coronation suddenly is heard, the lighting changes, and we have the feeling that the death is taking place almost from Richard's point of view, that he is struck and suddenly he is sliding away from the world. It is a very effective dramatic bit, leading all the way through in pantomime and slow motion to his final destruction, and then leading to a more realistic or normal approach to the end of the play and the final speeches of Richmond. I suppose that ends this comment. I would like to put one footnote here, Linda, and that is that the microphones, as I sat further back last night, seemed less effective than they had the first night I heard this. There is a tendency for voices to fade. There is a tendency for the sound effects man to get some voices at higher levels than others, so that things do not balance. And from a ways back in the amphitheater, there is sometimes a difficulty, particularly with the women, in determining who is speaking. I found this slightly irritating and had not expected to even notice it, since I did not notice it the first evening.